better off. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to A Pod of Their Own. I am Allison McCaig. This is episode 39 of A Pod of Their Own, and I am joined this week, as usual, by my lovely co-hosts, Linda Sarovich. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Allison.
And Maggie Wiggin. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Allison.
We are also joined this week by friend of the pod, recurring guest co-host. You guys know her and love her, moderator at Amazing Avenue, Kellyanne Healy. Hi, Kellyanne.
Hello, Allison. Hello, Maggie. And hello, Linda. And thank you for having me back again. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I'm banging everywhere.
So we're very happy to have Kellyanne on the show. We mostly have Kellyanne on the show because she is our resident literary correspondent. And as you guys know, this is our book pod this week. So in the second half of the show, we'll be talking about Baseball Maverick, the book about Sandy Alderson's tenure as general manager of the Mets. But in the meantime, we will do a brief Mets segment because spring training games have begun, which I guess is probably the most important Mets news. Yay! So yeah, there is actual like baseball happening. I haven't seen a single... Oh no, that's not true. I watched a little bit of it on Sunday. I did watch some of it on Sunday. I watched Franklin Kilame look not so good, if I recall.
Yeah.
No.
But, you know, games are happening. They don't count. It's kind of nice to watch spring training because it's like kind of like getting to enjoy baseball in a stress-free way, which is like nice.
It warms you up to caring.
Yes.
You're like, oh yes, baseball's back. This is awesome. And there's no pressure. That's great. And then you just start to like, all right, I think I'm ready to care.
Yeah.
Wait, is it
time.
Just me?
Let's care.
I very much care. Like,
but you don't care.
No, I care.
Are you like scoreboard watching?
Yes.
I am too.
The Nationals. I don't care. Like,
I mean, I'm scoreboard watching, but like, I know for me personally, just that first game where I'm hearing Gary, Keith, and Ron again.
I care deeply about that.
Their skill, but because they always make it, they make it hilarious when, because spring training games can get like pretty boring pretty fast sometimes, especially like early on when you're going through all the minor league players who aren't going to make the major league roster. You're kind of like, yeah, I want to pay attention to them, but also
The most boring spring training game in the history of the world occurred on March 22nd, 2017, and I know because I was in labor during it.
Oh god.
And I was like, oh yes, there's baseball on, something to like distract me. Like, I'd had the epidural. It was just sort of like, now I'm going to be awkward and uncomfortable for the next 8 hours and then there'll be a baby. And I was like, yes, baseball. Perfect. Just what I need. And I'm watching, I'm like, this is awful. This is so bad. Like it was one of those high scoring affairs. Like, nobody looked good. The parade of middle relievers was endless.
They're working on specific things that maybe like we lay people are not necessarily aware of. So we're like, oh my God, this is so bad. But they're like working on, like the pitchers are working on, maybe they're working on the changeup for the day, or maybe they're working on their fastball, or
I was their working on stuff too. I needed a good baseball game. They didn't give it to me.
Oh my gosh. But it, like, if they're working like on a specific thing and it's not like, oh, we have to pitch against the potent lineup of the Dodgers and this is like a must win game. No, it's not like that at this point in time.
Yeah, but like, nice. They bought Pham in the other day and he got two quick outs. He was like, okay, Pham back. And then he put two guys on. I'm like, oh no, the Familia experience is on. Oh, we got your two outs.
Oh, no,
here
he's
we go.
Really back.
Familia's really back now.
I'm getting flashbacks.
And not to be the like Debbie Downer in the conversation, but part of this podcast is being honest about our feelings. Be honest about your feelings, friends. I think that this year in particular, my spring training caring is dulled significantly by events in baseball as a whole. The whole like Astros like cheating scandal, I didn't think it would have as much of an impact on my caring about baseball being back as it has, but it really has. Like, I was like, ugh. Like, I think I will care, like, I will get really excited and happy again once, A, the Mets are, like, actually playing real games that count, and B, once, like, the Astros are no longer, like, dominating the storyline. But right now, it's still kind of that overlap where, like, games are happening, but the off-season, like, storylines and narratives haven't died off yet and haven't been dulled by baseball yet. So, like, I just feel so, like, cynical about the sport right now that it's, like, dulling my caring. And I hate it. I hate it. It's making me upset.
I'm the opposite because this is the first time the Astros have to play in front of fans. So that's making me more intrigued to see what the reaction's going to be. And so far, it's been pretty bad. Like, they've been booed. Altuve got booed. Like, even the players that had nothing to do with it. Like, their whole, like, minor league squad was in the other day, and they all got booed. Orbit got booed.
Yeah, that made me feel kind of bad because, like, it's not their fault.
They're going to get whacked all year long. Yeah. And I think that's something that we need to be, like,
prepared for,
as baseball fans, be prepared for, because that's gonna be something that sticks with them all year long. And especially if they do well, it's just like, oh, are they doing well because maybe they found another way to cheat? And, like, I hate saying that, because especially since, like, the 2017 Astros, that was, like, such a team that I was so excited to root for because Hurricane Harvey had just happened, and, like, there were just so many feel-good storylines around the Astros at that point. And to just kind of have that marred, and I think that's really the whole thing, is that it was such a positive team in 2017, and oh gosh, no, it actually really wasn't. They were cheating the entire time.
Yeah.
Which that's going to take a while for people to get over.
And they were, they've been unrepentant in their response too, which has made the whole thing worse. Like, they, like, really don't seem to give a shit.
Save for Jake Marisnik, but he's not on the team anymore, so he's with the Mets. But I would say his is the only apology from someone who was, like, embedded in it and kind of had, like, more of a veteran presence, like, say than J.D. Davis, who was a rookie, who was there for not very long at all. I don't remember how long he was there for. But he's the only one that's given, like, a solid, oh, I'm ashamed of this, I feel bad about this, it was wrong. He's the only one that's kind of said that. You know what I mean?
There's a couple other former Astros. Who's on the Twins now? I think he said something.
I don't know. See, I've only honestly been paying attention to, like, the Mets players that have been Astros, or the Mets, like, connections with the Astros, just due to life issues and whatnot. But
pretty much every former Astro on another team has apologized, and no current Astro has. I've been kind of watching.
Oh, jeez. Yikes. Just yikes.
But yeah.
That's hard to say.
I don't know. Oh. In an effort to kind of drum up my excitement about spring training, I was kind of trying to think of, like, and I know that we do this on Amazing Avenue every year on the site, and I think that we might run it again this year, but people haven't, like, coalesced to organize it yet, but it still might happen. People do their bold predictions every year. Like, the beat writers do this too, where they, like, come up with their bold predictions for the team for the coming season. And I had made, like, an impromptu bold prediction on the pod last time that I thought that Yoenis Cespedes was going to get more, like, was going to be healthier than Jed Lowry and was going to be worth more as far as WAR than Jed Lowry. That doesn't really feel like a bold prediction anymore. It seems kind of inevitable now. So I feel like I should do a new one. But do any of the three of you have, like, some bold hot takes about just predictions to share?
I'm going to go with, I think Stroman's going to have a big year.
Yeah, I sense that also.
I think the Mets bullpen.
I'll just say Stroman's going to be the Mets' best pitcher.
Ooh, damn, better than Jake?
That did get bold.
Like, 1A, 1B.
But how dare you?
I know, I'm so sorry, Jake. But, like, bad for Jake will be, like, a 2.10 ERA, and, like, Stroman will have, like, a 2.09.
Cool. I can dig it.
Okay. I think the Mets' bullpen will be good.
Whoa.
Whoa, 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 Meg.
I don't believe you, Maggie.
Look, no. I got my hometown boy. Batanzas is in that bullpen, and I think he's gonna help anchor it. I think it's gonna be. Look, we're talking bold predictions, right?
Yes.
If I went out there and said the bullpen's gonna be terrible, that wouldn't be very bold. So this is my bold. This is my choice.
Who's gonna be their closer?
Somebody. They'll figure it out. So it had to be bold. It didn't have to be specific.
Okay.
Kellyanne, how about you?
I have like 15 I'm thinking of right now. Okay. So I'll start with Jacob. Jacob will win his third Cy Young.
Hell
yeah. Is that bold?
I think it is bold.
Three is really hard.
It's
hard to do three in a row. It is hard to do. Scherzer's done three in a row, right?
I think he did three.
No, he hasn't? Okay.
He did three in four years, I think.
I feel like someone has three in a row. Or maybe I'm just crazy.
Randy Johnson had four in a row.
Randy Johnson, yeah. And I think Maddux did it?
Yes.
But I think that's it.
Okay. I'm going to go with Jake's going to win third Cy Young in a row. He will start the All-Star game. Finally, the Mets starting rotation will have the best overall ERA in baseball, both National and American League.
Damn.
Jeff McNeil is going to win the batting title, and the Mets will win 95 games.
Wow.
I'm going crazy here tonight.
Really bold.
Yes.
I could get behind that, though.
Yeah, and Mets will have, and I will make one more. And the Mets will have at least four All-Stars this year.
Oh, hell yeah.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, Stroman, Jay, McNeil, and Pete. There you go.
I was going to say DeGrom, Alonso, McNeil, and J.D. Davis.
Oh, J.D.
I'm going to shout out to your mans, Linda.
Thank you. That makes me so happy. Hopefully his shoulder is okay.
So I'll just build on my bold prediction because before I said that Cespedes was going to have more value than Jed Lowry. I don't feel like that's bold anymore. I feel like that's probably the more likely scenario. But I'll go bolder and say, because before I had said, and I think Cespedes will accrue more than one WAR, I'll go bolder and say, I think Cespedes will accrue more than two WAR.
All right. I can
get behind that, and B, I'm also going to add Cespedes will win comeback player of the year. I'm just being super positive about the Mets right now.
Cespedes,
I don't know why.
Cespedes, Edwin Diaz, Dellin Betances, three-headed comeback player of the year.
Oh, hell yeah.
I would also like to see Cespedes bring back his song.
Yes!
It was just called like Potencia, right? No, not that one. The one that he had written for him.
Oh, yes. The La Potencia song.
He's got the power.
I want the neon sleeves.
That's the bird. I want everything back. I want him back. I want his music back. I want the sleeves back. I want the rally parakeet back. I just want the energy that he brought to this team back. Because people have opinions on Cespedes, yes. Especially the silly beat writers. But he brought an energy and a positivity and just a joy to the clubhouse in 2015 and 2016, in my opinion, that I don't want to say has been missing, but it's been a different dynamic without him, for sure.
Well, I'm glad you said clubhouse, because pretty much the media narrative is, oh, he's a bad teammate, he's a bad influence, his antics cause problems. Find me one instance of a player complaining about him or saying he's a distraction. Find me a player going on the record saying that and not a media-driven narrative. And I bet you nobody can find a single instance of that happening because it's not true. Yeah. But it's not a problem.
No.
And I can prove it. He didn't play for how long? 2 years? A year? And he was there. He showed up at David Wright's last game after not playing. And he barely was a teammate of David Wright, considering both of their injuries. And yet he was there at Citi Field to say goodbye and to, you know, honor David Wright and what he's meant to this organization. And may I add, when he was shown on the big screen, everybody in that stadium cheered.
Yes.
So I was like, I want to say it's the vocal minority that buys into, you know, Cespedes is a team problem, and it's not what the majority think.
Well, we also know he's not really a team problem because they can't come up with anything actually problematic to write. Like, Harvey refused to pitch out of the bullpen, or like, you know, I mean, even Jose Reyes was like, you know, bitching about playing time, but like all they can come up with for Cespedes is like, oh no, he messed with a boar on his property. He has lots of cars.
Like, humiliating and embarrassing, and it's just like he's working on his farm and
if he was a problem in that clubhouse, there would have been more stories about it. They would love to tell those stories if they could come across any of them, but they can't because he's obviously not a problem in the clubhouse.
Right.
And what the problem is whenever they wrote about him, it was always tied to his salary. Like, they were like implying he's stealing money because he was hurt in earning this money. Like, there was no need to always say in the same breath, Yoenis Cespedes, who's making $29 million this year, is sitting on the bench. There's no need to say that. And there was two beat writers who were very good at pointing that out every single time. And, like, what are you gaining by pointing that out? We know. And do you think he feels good about that? No.
Yeah.
Well, he's like, not getting paid $29 million anymore. So there you go.
Exactly. And that's the thing is, like, and that's how you know that they've, like, ceased to argue in good faith, not that they ever were to begin with, but, like, that's how you know that these are bad faith arguments, because, well, the latest, in case our listeners are not caught up on this whole situation, the latest slew of Cespedes hit pieces have come as a result of the fact that he had told the media upon arriving at Port St. Lucie that he didn't want to talk to them. Which,
shocker.
If you are in his position, and I said this about Matt Harvey at the time, I've said it about Noah Syndergaard, I've said it about, like, countless other Mets players that the media has trashed during their time in New York for no reason. Like, can you blame him for not wanting to talk to the media? No. But anyhow, that caused the media to double down, obviously, and continue to write ridiculous hit pieces about him. And in one of them, I was reading, of course, take it with a grain of salt, it's even worse than, like, the Post. It's WFAN. But the writer made a point to, again, mention his salary and in calling him spoiled and, you know, entitled, which were actual words he used. He mentioned his salary again, as they always mention, and he didn't mention the resettlement at all, and clearly on purpose, because, like, he's not actually making $29 million this year. He's making six.
Yeah. But all of a sudden that argument is a lot harder to stand behind.
Like, it's just, and yeah, so I mean,
almost like it has nothing to do with money at all.
Fascinating.
What could it be?
So the most egregious, and I made a tweet about this, and my Twitter mentions are like a trash fire right now, folks. Don't tweet about Cespedes, because apparently folks have takes. I tweeted a screen cap of what I thought was like one of the more offensive snippets of these hit pieces from who else than Kevin Kernan. He's been one of the worst perpetrators. It's basically been him, Sherman, and Martino have been like the worst.
Well, and E. Hall, but he no longer covers the Mets.
That's true. Have been like the worst perpetrators of this stuff. Like Sherman was the one who wrote the hat backwards thing. Ugh. Andy Martino was the one who constantly like called Cespedes like lazy and called him quixotic at one point, which is like,
yeah, he got out his thesaurus on that
basically a Mad Libs of thinly veiled racism.
Yeah. And like Kernan has literally made tweets in the past about like every time like Cespedes didn't run out of ground ball, he would tweet something like, I know who has a column next week. Like, he literally salivates at writing this shit. Anyway, So he, in his latest hit piece, which people were like, oh, it was a pretty positive article. I was like, did you read it beyond the like headline, which seemed positive? There was so much thinly veiled contempt in there. Like, so here's the sentence that caught my eye. Yet Cespedes preferred to play the part of a rancher, but baseball is his meal ticket. But every time a contract is about to expire, Cespedes hears a bell, a reminder again, he is a baseball player.
Ugh.
Those are certainly words that you've put in a fucking sentence together. First of all, other than it just being a completely, like, nonsense word salad, like, there's just so much here to unpack. Like, implying that he's only motivated to come back to the field because it's his contract year, for one. Second of all, that he's playing the part of a rancher. He owns a ranch, therefore he is a rancher. Like, the fact that
baseball players... Well, and, like, not only does he own it, but he works on it. Like, that's
his life.
And why he lost all that money in the resettling, because he's working on his ranch. Like,
and I feel like that's always been something that's been known about him as well, that he's always had this love of ranching in addition to loving baseball. In fact, I feel like, and this might, like, pee some people off, but, like, he wants to be a rancher. Like, that's his goal in life. I mean, that's like, he's got thoughts beyond baseball, which I think is great personally.
Yeah, exactly.
We see so many players kind of become like listless and directionless after they retire. But obviously he's not.
The impulse.
And some players are afforded the privilege of a hobby seen as something quirky or interesting about them. You know, Madison Bumgarner is like dirt bike riding. And what's the other thing? Oh, my
secret
brain just
rodeos.
Went totally blank.
Oh, rodeos.
Yeah, rodeos. And literally, it was like, oh, Mad Bum, what a card, lols. And like, that's fine. But why isn't that personality allowed of players who are less American?
Yeah.
Less like all American, shiny around the edges, just that like glowing.
I'll say it.
Big man on campus. Yeah. Right. It's really that's the thing, is that Madison Bumgarner is the right kind of player to go out and do wants and have it be cool and funny. And Cespedes has to play by a different set of rules. And he has so far not been willing to do that. And that's why we love him. That's what makes him amazing. That he's like, no, screw you. I am quirky. I'll have my quirky hobby. You can't take that away from me.
Ranching to me even isn't even a quirk. It's like an actual productive, difficult, challenging job. Whereas like this whole thing with Madison Bumgarner has been ticking me off, because it's just, that's a legitimate like leisure activity that's dangerous to his career and his contract. And ranching is, I don't know, not. Is an actual occupation. You know what I mean?
Other than like wild boars, I guess.
Bumgarner already was out because of the ATV accident.
Because of low stupidity!
Yeah, so he's being reckless just to be reckless, and it has cost him, and yet it's like, oh, that's just Mad Bum being Mad Bum. Oh, funny guy.
Like, when I pointed out this double standard on Twitter, my replies were full of, obviously it's because Cespedes injured himself while doing it. I was like, Madison Bumgarner, like flew off a cliff riding dirt bikes. Like, are you kidding me? Oh,
that's
my
okay,
god
though. That's okay though, because
that's
he's cool. Won World Series championship, so
that's the other one. It's like, oh well, when Cespedes is an MVP, he can whatever, and it's like,
I don't mind Jacob DeGrom skydiving
World Series in 2015. That's not anything, you know. That's not anything. Yeah. That doesn't count.
Yes, forget. Thank you for explaining to me. I was asleep the entire 2010s. I was unaware that Madison Bumgarner's won 3 World Series. Thanks. Thanks for explaining.
But like, does that mean Mike Trout can just do whatever the hell he wants because he's never won a World Series?
I guess.
I guess since Madison Bumgarner won a World Series, that means he can go swimming with sharks, go bungee jumping, go riding on a bull. Isn't it a bull? It's not even a horse.
Yeah, I don't know.
God, I think you're right.
Ugh. Like, it's a bowl.
I just remember one of the things I read specified that he was doing the roping with his other hand.
Oh,
and okay. It's like, okay.
Okay, that makes it all better.
Fine. I mean, whatever. Like, the thing about this that just, like, ticks me off above all else is, like, that it's just, again, this is all goes back to the, like, commodification of players and and, like, the dehumanization of them. Like, you're reducing them to this one-dimensional idea of, like, you are baseball player, you are not a human being with complexities and, like, facets to you, you are just baseball player, and that is your only value to society. Like, that's just bullshit. It's bullshit.
You're here for my entertainment.
Like, you know, you are paying them a lot of money, so I get why you don't want them taking, like, unnecessary risks. But being a rancher is not an unnecessary risk.
Yeah. Like...
Yeah, that's the whole... Like, to me, there's a major difference between ranching and between rodeo and motorcycle biking. Oh my god, wow. That's a sentence I would like to take back right there. Motorcycling or ATV or whatever Bumgarner was doing. I don't know.
Like, I know the Mets had an issue when Dickie wanted to, what, climb Everest?
Yeah, they did.
Kilimanjaro.
Oh, Kilimanjaro. Yes. Okay. a little different than Everest. But I can see that being, you know, kind of dangerous too. But there's still a big difference between that and ranching.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. And
like obviously he violated the terms of his contract, or else they wouldn't have restructured it
and negotiated it down.
Like, that was, you know, the union would have stepped in. Like, that was, it's pretty clear that, you know, letter of the law, that he violated those terms. But you know what? He's literally paid the price. He's figuratively paid the price with freaking surgery on busted up ankles. Like, he did his time for that. Let him join this baseball team again. Let him be kind of that presence that was so wonderful for this team. Let him do that.
And he is working his ass off to get back. He is.
Right. Yeah. Yep. No, he's lazy and unmotivated, but Jed Lowry is gritty and a fighter.
Oh my god. He exists.
He exists. He's playing. He's playing in a knee brace, and, like, they're talking about how, like, he just needs to get used to playing in the knee brace, yada yada. And so it seems like, and Yoenis Cespedes, like, he actually did end up speaking to the media eventually and clarified what he meant essentially by saying, like, I'll talk to you guys about, like, my process of getting back and looking to the future. I'm just not going to talk about the accident, so don't ask me about it, which is a perfectly reasonable stance to take. But yeah, it seems like Yoenis Cespedes is, like, going to be ready for opening day, at least, so he claims. This was, like, a couple of days ago. He said he was about 80% running and 90% fielding, and it's clear that he can, like, mash taters, at least in BP, as usual. So, like, it seems like he's going to get into games by, like, mid-March or so, and, like, if that's enough time to get ready, who knows, he might be a step or two slow or behind everybody else to start the year, but he intends to be ready for opening day is the implication there.
I am stupidly,
he looks great.
His ass off to get back.
Yes.
I am so stupidly excited for Yo Dongs.
I know, I just want...
If he hits anything less than 40 dongs this year, I'm gonna be disappointed.
I just want him to silence the haters so much. Like,
I feed off of it.
To constantly question the motivation of a dude who defected from his home country to play baseball is just infuriating. Like, you are a piece of shit. Stop using this, like, racist coded language every chance you get. Like, it won't kill you to, like, be a little less racist.
It just reminds me of when everybody was giving him hell for that ridiculous, and I do mean ridiculous in a good way, that ridiculous car collection.
Yeah.
And he was taking all of this shit, and he finally said in an interview, he's like, well, in Cuba, I wasn't allowed to have a car.
Yeah.
And everyone's, and of course, like, nobody was actually appropriately, you know, humbled by that. No one actually acknowledged that they had screwed up big time when they you know, questioned his seriousness or his focus because of cars. But like, that was it. That's why you don't make assumptions about somebody's worth based on these like race coded surface level things, like lazy or, you know, greedy, when it's, there's so much more depth and of understanding when you just talk to the person and listen to what they have to say and take them for who they are.
Mm-hmm. And I think no one appreciates the American dream more than he does, but he apparently mm-hmm. can't wear a cowboy hat without someone saying he's playing the part because he's brown. Like, fuck you. The worst. Anyway. I think we can move on. I've done enough screaming about that, but it's infuriating. It makes me mad. It makes me really mad. But
Cespedes so can mad too.
Silence them by doing well, and I want nothing more than that. I suppose the last like Mets storyline before we move on is there was an article today in the Post, and this might just be like artificial like inflating of the spring training competition for rotation spots, as usually happens, but take it for what you will. There was an article in the Post about how like Mats and Waka are battling for the fifth rotation spot without like even really mentioning Porcello, just like assuming that Rick Porcello is like the fourth starter now because of reasons. I don't know.
He earned it?
Cy Young Award winning?
Yeah, former Cy Young Award winner Rick Porcello.
I guess that one inning the other day really put him over the edge. That sealed the deal.
And I also like the title, Mets Thinking Way Outside the Box for Final Rotation Spot. Like, I was like, huh, I wonder what the way outside the box means. Oh, Mats and Waka are battling for it. Like,
well, they were also saying they would do matchups, like maybe have Gizelman be an opener like have one of them pitch afterwards. And so there was more to it. But then, of course, Waka said he was promised a spot when they signed him. I was like, of course.
Which that I believe in a heartbeat. Jesus, the Mets have to stop doing that.
Like, it's Devin Mesoraco all over again. Happy retirement, Michael Waka.
I was just so baffled when I read that, like, Mats was competing for a spot. I was like, wait, what? I mean, his ERA was, like, rough. Like, I shouldn't even say rough. I mean, I'm looking at his BRAF page right now. It was 421, but, like, he started 32 games. He pitched 160 innings. He had over 150 strikeouts. I mean,
he was better in the second half.
Like, I don't think he merited, like, being pushed into this competition for a fifth spot. I was like, wait, what?
Yeah, they've been trying this nonsense with Mats for, I feel like, every season now. They're like, well, you know, maybe we like Mats better out of the bullpen. And, like, every year he just is like a quietly above average pitcher and has now been healthy for what, two straight seasons? Like,
yeah,
it's such a weird fixation to have. Like, and stop trying to get the young lefty out of your rotation. Jeez.
Yeah, and like Mets' home and road splits were really bad. Like, he was really, really good at home, so I don't know how you can just
And his road splits are heavily skewed by that one nightmare start in Philly, which, like,
yeah,
you know, you can't pretend that didn't happen. But when you're looking at a subset of a sample, like a split like that, it's just going to have a much bigger impact overall than if you're just looking at the season numbers.
Right.
But like, I don't know, it's just every other team in baseball would love to have him in their rotation. And, like, I don't understand the Mets' obsession with trying to get him out.
Yeah.
I just love how, like, this is just the usual Mets shit. Like, we're going to promise the veteran things, and then we're going to continue to, like, fuck with our young guy because we feel like it. Like, that's just, like, that's very extremely Mets. Extremely Mets.
Because you're paying the veteran guy money.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, it was like the article even said, like, the Mets see Rick Porcello as a starting pitcher with little relief utility. Like, then why'd you sign him?
And yeah, I would say those two things are not necessarily related. Not having utility in the bullpen and being a starter. I don't think he is either of those things.
Right.
Well, see, I'm gonna have a soft spot for Porcello all season long, just because A, he's a Jersey guy, B, he's went to Seton Hall Prep, and was in like the Catholic school circle, because I went to an all-girls school that was also kind of like closely in that Catholic school circle. So it's just like, he knows people that I know, and I feel so weird saying that, but like I have a soft spot for him.
He's a Mets fan. Spot.
Yeah, he's true. A Mets fan. So I hope he finds success however he is used. If he's a starter, if he's a reliever, I just want him to do well. I want him to like do better than people are saying that he is right now.
Oh yeah.
Because I know he's not I cannot for the life of me remember the year he won the Cy Young. I know he won it. I can't remember what year, but I know he's not that pitcher anymore, but I think he can be better than what people are saying he's going to be. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I'm rooting for him. Like, I want nothing but success for Rick Porcello. If Rick Porcello succeeds, the team is a lot better. It's just odd how they, like, completely, like, kicked Steven Matz to the curb and penciled Porcello as the fourth starter. Like, what?
Yeah, the Mets front office is doing Mets front office-y nonsense. That's not
good. Usual Mets shit. But, you know, if all six of these pitchers are healthy and effective, then that bodes well for the season, for certain.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyhow, we will now transition to the second half of the show, which will be a book discussion. So we all in the intervening since last podcast read varying amounts of Baseball Maverick. Either some of us had read it before, some of us were reading it for the first time. Baseball Maverick. I'm gonna grab my copy. I have it right here. Baseball Maverick.
We read different versions.
some of us read different versions. Because the book, for those of you who don't know, so Baseball Maverick is a book by Steve Kettman about Sandy Alderson's tenure as general manager of the Mets, and the book was first written in 2014, and obviously right the year after 2014 was a pretty big year for the Mets and for Sandy Alderson. So the book like had an addendum added to it, and then a new edition was released to include details from the 2015 season. So Kellyanne is missing that bit.
What happened in 2015? I don't know.
You missed the ending. You missed the best part.
No, the middle spoilers. Was pretty good too.
So if you don't want to know what happens in 2015 and you're spoiler conscious, feel free to skip this segment. Spoiler alert.
To walk off the show right now. Oh goodness.
It was a really fun read. And it's just very interesting to read, with some distance between the Sandy Alderson tenure and the present. So it kind of for me at least served as like more of a reflection on the Sandy Alderson era. So what did you guys think? Like, how do you think that reading this book now in the lens of like Brody Van Wagenen era Mets and like post 2015 Mets, how do you think that changes your perception of the Sandy Alderson era Mets?
For me, I first read it after it came out, and reading it then was a lot more enjoyable than reading it now. Because now I know the ending, and it's not good. So, like, I know how David Wright's career ends up. I know how Matt Harvey's career ends up. I know Cespedes doesn't go the way we want. So I kind of miss that feeling reading that book and having that hope and that excitement from that era of all of them coming up. And, you know, also just reliving that, saying, like, oh, no, we have, like, Noah Syndergaard's whole career in front of us now. We have Jacob deGrom's whole career in front of us now. We have Zach Wheeler. We have Matt Harvey. And they're going to be good forever. And it's going to be great. And we're going to win a championship. And, you know, now we didn't get our happy ending. And it kind of makes me sad. But at the same time, there were like little nuances to it too, like talking about Robinson Cano and how Sandy really wanted to sign him. And but I think like the money just he was like, I would never be able to match what he got. And now here's Cano, like years later, now we have Robinson Cano. So like that was kind of funny to reread. And another thing that also was kind of funny to reread now was when Jacob deGrom came up in 2014 and he started getting elbow soreness. So he was in the hospital and Sandy was in the neighborhood or lived in the neighborhood. So he decided to visit him in the hospital. And in the next room over was Jeremy Hefner, who just got diagnosed and needing a second Tommy John. And like in the book he wrote, he found two pitchers whose careers were going in opposite directions. And now here they both are again. There's Jacob deGrom with two Cy Youngs, and now Jeremy Hefner's his coach. So it's like, you know, it's little things like that too that's kind of fun to pick up on. But I had a lot better time reading it right after the 2015 season than I did now. Because it is sad. They're like, it's hard to kind of like separate the ending now from what was.
Yeah. I think what I found really interesting thinking about where the Mets are now is what I always found the most interesting about the book was all of the biographical background on Sandy Alderson. Cause like he had an atypical experience in life. Like, and like, kind of sought out a lot of it himself. Like I think one of my favorite anecdotes is he's on vacation in college, and what he decides to do in college is go visit his dad. Sure, who wouldn't want to visit their dad during college? Well, his dad is deployed in Vietnam, so he just like flies into Vietnam, like, you know, saunters over to where his dad, and like that's how he spends spring break. Like, he doesn't go to Cabo, he goes to Nam. And it's just like sets up this real sense of like who he is, like what is the mindset behind this guy, and like, you know, what brings him into, it's funny, he almost like falls into baseball. Like, he was a lawyer at the time. It was very like a lot of happenstance in a way, but he was also just found that he was incredibly good at it. And so it's an interesting read just to understand like where, you know, how, who he is, like his personality, and like how his life brought him to baseball, and like how, thinking about how all of that impacted who he was and how he, you know, carried himself when he was in Queens. But then to think about Brody, who like, I mean, granted, you know, there is no biography, authorized biography of Brody Van Wagenen to try to understand similarly, but like he's so opaque and he's got this very like this very polished costumey exterior of like, and like he's if you saw him on the street you'd be like, oh, that guy's a sports agent. Like there's no he's like Jerry Maguire before he has the like clarity of mind moment. And that's, I don't know, and it just makes just the way kind of understanding who Sandy Alderson is casts some light on how he carried himself in this role. It makes you think about who Brody is and how he carries himself. And it's a really interesting contrast. That popped out to me.
Yeah, I'm also agree.
That popped out to me as well.
Piggybacking off of that, like Sandy to the media came off like kind of like cool, and like he would come out with like some one-liners and whatever, but in the book he's like screaming at umpires and like screaming at I forget who the pitcher was, that he was like, throw a fucking fastball, and like he had this intense competitiveness to him, and like it was something that I didn't expect. And we know Brody threw a chair.
Well,
but
I just remember the anecdote from the 2015 NLDS against the Dodgers after the whole Tejada Utley situation.
Imagine he was pacing.
And Alderson was pacing, but like he was also overheard screaming at Was it the umpire or was it Joe
Torre? I think
Torre?
It was Torre. He was pacing outside. It was either Torre or the umpire.
But, like, they heard him, like, literally screaming at him. And I was like, whoa.
Like, there was this fire, like, Sandy cared. Like, that's what Sandy that helped me too. Is Sandy cares.
Sandy loves baseball. Sandy cared. And he cared deeply about this. And that's what I got from this book. And I also, I picked up from this, because actually this was the first time I read this. I read this like kind of in bits and pieces, and this is the first time I read it in full. And I have the version without the 2015 addendum. But my whole thing was like, there was this whole thing of like, there was the Wilpons were somehow holding Sandy back. It wasn't like specifically said, but like, I felt like, oh my God, what would Sandy Alderson be like if the Mets had better owners that were willing to invest more from top to bottom, that were invested in more progressive technologies, more progressive statistics and mm-hmm. methods of health, and just so many different things that I think Sandy tried to employ, but was also held back from implementing because of Fred and Jeff Wilpon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember they specifically reference in the book at the like when he came on to be GM of the Mets, he obviously was aware of the Madoff Ponzi scheme and the fallout of that and the fact that the team's finances would be impacted, but he wasn't aware just how much. And like they had called it in the book, like him coming in to manage this, like to manage the like big market Mets, they called it Moneyball with money, but then it wasn't with money.
No.
And so, yeah, it's clear that you're left to wonder like what he could have achieved if he had been able to run up the payrolls that someone like Omar Anaya was able to during his time with the Mets, what Sandy Alderson could have achieved. And yeah, like the contrast, what Maggie said struck me as well. The contrast between Sandy Alderson and Brody Van Wagenen in this book is like, well, obviously it's Brody Van Wagenen is in the book, but it's just so stark because like, I think a lot about the parts of the book where they talk about how he used to wear like shorts all the time and how like Billy Bean during his time with the A's, how Billy Bean like didn't realize like that dude's from Harvard. Like what? Like he didn't have, I think Billy Bean called it something like bow tie stuffiness of like of like other general managers of that era. Like Sandy Alderson was a very different kind of guy, a more laid back, more California vibes with his shorts and everything. And you just think about like Brody Van Wagenen's like used car salesman, sports agent look and how it's so completely different. And how like Sandy Alderson's like wry sense of humor is so completely different from Brody Van Wagenen's demeanor. And
yeah. His sense of humor was so, I think, underappreciated when he was here. Like he would make so many like very dry quips to the media that were just passed over. But
What Outfield like, is an all-time classic. I'm what sorry.
Like, so good.
Wow. The other thing this book made me like really wish and hope for, and I mean I guess it's still possible but I highly doubt it, is I would love to see Sandy Alderson as the commissioner of baseball, like especially with Rob Manfred right now and how he's handling the Astros and how he's kind of just treated baseball on the whole. I don't get a sense of love of the game from Rob Manfred or like a sense of like especially with the World Series quote about the World Series, I think rings just like being a piece of metal, and it's just like that's such a disservice to the work that these players put in for 162 games, listen to me, like 200 plus games, like counting spring training, counting playoffs, and God knows what they do in the off season. That's just such, that was such a disservice to them. And so I don't know, I got Sandy's love of baseball from this book, that he really does love this game. He thinks about this game in a very intellectual and atypical way from, I think, most people, but it's clear that he loves the game. That's my thing that I like got the most, the biggest thing I picked up, I think, was that he really does love this game. He's not going to always show it, and he's probably not going to show it in the way that people expect, but he really loves this game and he cares about this game.
Well, and it's also the little things too. Like, he knew, he had to have known that he wasn't going to have money to spend. So I think it was after, I can't remember what season or what before one season, he sat down, like, Curtis Granderson, David Wright, a couple of the other veterans, to see what the deal was with offense at Citi Field and why they couldn't score at home. So he sat down with them and, like, took them out to dinner and was like, can I have your thoughts? And they're like, well, I think we could flip, like, when we eat, because if we eat too late, then it kind of throws us off. So, like, he ended up implementing some of their suggestions. And so it was, you know, like, even little things you could do to get better, like that, mm-hmm. instead of always, like, you know, making the free agent signing, like, you had to kind of look at even see the forest for the trees, basically. And
he listened to the players. That was clear. I mean, like, the night of the Flores non-trade, lost in that was that Wheeler, like, specifically called him and said, I don't want to be traded. So, I mean, and Sandy could have just, like, thrown that, like, let that slide and go in one ear and out the other, but he didn't. So, I don't know. I won't lie, I miss Sandy Alderson as general manager.
He seemed to sort of cross generations, really. Like, he came kind of at the tail end of these, like, scruffy, old-timey baseball dudes. And was followed by this generation of, like, the Ivy League, like Moneyball spreadsheet sort of types. But he has the Ivy League background. Like, he went to Harvard, but he wasn't there for finance. Like, he's not coming from a background of, like, big business. And it's really interesting. I think that's partly why he doesn't seem to have a lot of comparisons in the game. Like, there's not a lot of, you don't hear anybody as, like, the new Sandy Alderson, you know? He fit in this kind of very narrow little sliver of baseball history, I think.
Well, and I think we've talked about it on the pod before, about every single, like, Mets PR disaster. We always wonder, would this happen if Sandy was still there? Because he just seemed like he would not take that or nip it in the bud and be like, we can't have this. I don't know if that's, like, his Marine background but Brody just doesn't seem equipped, like Sandy was, to handle some of these disasters that end up blowing up bigger than they should have. If there was somebody with that kind of take charge frame of mind saying, we gotta, you know, just nip this in the bud, don't let it blow up to spectacular proportions, don't add to it by throwing a chair. Mm-hmm. And so it makes me miss Sandy too, because you do wonder just how different things would be under him now.
That struck me also. I think it becomes apparent when reading this book that another underappreciated thing about Sandy Alderson is how much he seemed to be keeping a lid on the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And once he was gone, the lol Mets just, like, escaped out into the ether, and he was the one that was, like, kind of tampering the whole thing down the whole time. Like, he was the adult in the room the whole time.
Yeah.
You don't appreciate how much that's true until you have some, you know, some hindsight into the whole thing now. So yeah,
and he was not a saint, to be fair.
No,
you know, he wasn't. He certainly, like, went and acquired Jose Reyes, among other things. Like, you know, he's still part of this system that is ultimately kind of a messed up system. And he carried water for the Wilpons throughout. He had every opportunity to kind of call them out on their BS. And, like, you know, yes, they did kind of stick him with a raw deal, but also he stuck around for it. I think he signed at least one additional like contract extension while he was with them. So like, you know, I think it gets easy to remember all the good stuff, but I do just want to be clear that like he had plenty of his own warts, and not giving him a pass on, especially the Reyes thing. Like that was really, I know it was maybe not his idea, but he did it.
And I mean, Reyes and Familia. And I mean, there were other like mistakes you could say he made with like trades. Like you could argue about the Cespedes trade with Fulmer and Luis Sessa. Who's the other one? You could argue about Michael Kadire. I feel like there's another one I'm forgetting.
Well, all of his like outfield moves, it was always that one outfielder, like, oh, like first it was John Mayberry, then it was Deaza,
and then like there was Chris Young, and there
Chris Young
for like a brief time. So I mean, obviously he's not a perfect general manager, no, but just like comparing him to what we have now is just,
and also the near misses too. Like, I think he originally wanted Dylan Bundy for R.I. Dickey. I think he first wanted to trade him to the Orioles.
Yep, he almost traded R.A. Dickey to the Orioles for Dylan Bundy instead of Noah Syndergaard and Travis d'Arnaud, which would have been, I mean, I'm Birdland. I love me some Dylan Bundy, but that would have been an unmitigated disaster. Like, Dylan Bundy is not half the pitcher Noah Syndergaard is. Like, he's fine. Like, he's, you know, like, Dylan Bundy is a major league pitcher and would have been a solid, like, back-end starter, but he's not Noah Syndergaard.
This is a great book for wild trade proposal ideas.
Yes.
Like, I don't know if it's standard practice. Like, I'm not a GM, but the Rangers thought they had a deal for Beltran, and then all of a sudden he's getting traded to the Giants, and they're like, what?
Yep, that was funny.
So I don't know if that was kind of like a dick move on Sandy's part or if that's just standard practice as a GM. I don't know.
It could be both.
That would have been a wild one too.
I think I'm with Maggie on that one. I think it's both. I think it's both a dick move, but it's also standard practice.
I think the standard practice is that GMs are generally dicks.
Yeah, probably. I mean, you can't.
Have to be.
You can't really be a GM without being like, a little bit of a
especially dick. In higher, in bigger, big market cities like New York or LA.
Is New York a big market city? That's news to me, Kellyanne.
New York's a mid market or like a small market. Who are we kidding? Especially the Mets.
The Queens is a small market team.
Goodness gracious. No, but just. There's an added element being in a big city, I think, that you kind of, like, the general manager is going to have to adopt or have a facet of their personality kind of be an asshole, in a sense.
Yeah.
I don't want to say asshole, that's not, like, the right word, but you know what I'm trying to say, right?
Well, you have that many more people who are expecting you to please them. And so that's that many more people that you are just not going to be able to please all the time. Yeah. So you kind of have to be like, you know, well, sorry, kids.
Yeah.
Not going to
let it roll off your shoulders.
Yeah.
Side note, this is like random, but I really liked the story of just because it tickled me of the like the Yankees 4-game sweep saving Ike Davis and Ruben Tejada from being demoted. Like,
oh, and also to be fair, bringing up Ike Davis too, he made the right decision on the Dickey Duda, the Davis Duda conundrum.
Yes,
he sure did.
So, and new exit velocity.
Use the exit velocity.
Yep, that's the one.
And everybody said it at the time that Duda would have been, I think, let me qualify that. When I say everybody, I mean the general tenor on Amazing Avenue at the time, because that was the time that I had just like joined in 2014, I think, or 15 that happened. The general tenor was that was the correct decision, that Davis wasn't going to pan out. That dude had a lot more potential. That dude's exit velocity was off the bat was great, even if it wasn't like translating just yet. So, yeah. That was the general tenor on the Amazing Avenue commenting board at the time.
And he made the right decision between Wright and Reyes, too.
Sure did. But, you know, he brought Reyes back. But,
yeah.
You know.
But at the time, it was the crisis.
We'll qualify that with at the time, because he brought him back in 2016. Oh, my God.
But, yeah, so, you know, I enjoyed this book. I didn't get through all of it, but I'm close to being done with it, and I will finish it very shortly.
The 2015 stuff is fun to read.
Yeah, even I bet it is.
It is fun to, you know, relive that. And just now, too, like, just looking back on that time, and like I said, you know, you kind of thought they were set up for success for a while, and I don't know if we have an equivalent of that right now. Like, we have Pete and Conforto, but there's nobody, like, really in the pipeline saying, like, okay, here we go. When they come up, we're going to really take off, and we're going to take this thing. And, you know, I kind of miss having that excitement and that hope. And it's like, basically what we see is what we get right now. And we just have to hope what we have is good enough.
I mean, there will never be another stretch of calling up the next pitcher from the minors like the Mets had for those years. Like, that was just, and when I say, I have trouble thinking any team will have that. Like, they just, over a period of, 3 years, they called up 5 megastar pitchers. I mean, not all of them turned into megastars, but, like, it certainly seemed at the time, like, that well was never going to run dry.
Yeah, and they all, like, hit the ground running and were good immediately. Like,
yeah.
Even though their careers have taken various twists and turns since then, either due to, like, them maxing out their potential or due to injury in the case of Matt Harvey especially, but like every single one of them was at least pretty good immediately.
Yeah,
they if not really great were. In the case of Harvey.
Yeah, so. And there was Jacob deGrom, who was kind of like the bonus.
Yeah,
nobody expected that. It was like, hey, look, we got another one. Who knew?
Look, a freebie.
Yeah, I found this. I mean, like. Yeah, like Linda said, it does put a little bit of a damper on it when you think about, like, how things have panned out and how it didn't, like, put the Mets on the fast track to a prolonged era of success. But the fun part, and we chatted about this a little bit pre-show, but since we weren't recording, I'll say it again. the part that I found fun about reading this personally was that, like, 2009 through 2013 were the years that I was in college. So I, like, didn't watch a lot of Mets games during that period because I went to college outside of the New York media market. So I didn't have access to the Mets games, and my parents didn't let me get MLB.TV. I resented them for that, but they were right because I probably would have flunked out of school because I would have been watching the stupid Mets all the time. Allowed me to focus on my studies. But as a result, I really didn't watch that many Mets games. I only watched them when they played the Phillies because I was in the Philadelphia media market in college. So I watched the Mets Phillies games mostly with the horrible Phillies announcers. But yeah, so like getting to relive, like, especially 2010 through 2013 was fun for me in this book because, like, I mean, obviously I remember the big parts of it. Like, I remember Matt Harvey, like, and the bloody nose game and all that. Like, how can you forget that? But like some of the smaller details of that era of Mets, even though there weren't like a ton of highlights to remember, there were some. And so looking back on that era, as someone who didn't watch a ton of, wasn't like entirely steeped in it during that time, was fun. So.
Well, for me too, I mean, I don't know if everybody's read Ron Darling's book, like this quote always stood out for me is, when in his Game 7 book, he said that they won in spite of him and not because of him, because he kind of stunk it up Game 7. And he said for him, the moment was like everybody else, you know, thinks it of as a happy moment. And for him, it's bittersweet. And he said, I have a hard time separating the bitter from the sweet. And that's kind of how I view that era now, is in hindsight, it is bittersweet. Like, it was fun at the time, and I miss that feeling, and I had so much fun during that run. And but now there is that little tinge of bitter that I don't know that's ever going to go away because of how David Wright's career turned out. Like, that was his last shot, and now we just got to hope maybe he gets a ring as, you know, in the front office or something, but then it won't be the same. And, you know, I mean, I love Pete, I love JD, I love Jake, I want them to do well, but Dave was Dave, and, you know, so it's just always going to be that little tinge of bitter to go along with the sweetness of those years that did bring a lot of fun and joy back to Mets baseball. And I am very thankful that that happened, and I'm very thankful to Sandy for that, because it had been so long, and, you know, 2006 was the last time. I mean, it was a long time. So I don't want to experience that drought again. So let's go, guys. Like, it's time. Let's get on this. So, but, you know, it's a double-edged sword now, looking back on that period.
Yeah.
It is, but, like, for me, it is, I don't know why I can separate. I've always been able to separate, like, the whole 2015 series from the 2015 World Series.
Yeah, so I could forget that World Series even happened.
What World Series? They ended it after the NLCS. It was so weird, but, well, whatever.
That was fun.
But just the journey, that whole 2015 season, from the 11... I believe it was an 11 game streak. It was an 11 game streak in April to, like, the, oh my God, to the torrid May and June where they didn't have any offense. And then the return, but, like, they had Mats come up, and then the whole, this kind of jump start at the end of July. And what?
And Conforto.
I know Conforto coming up and hitting the ground running, which was, oh, He's still an underrated player too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Are so many of the 2015 players still on the team? I'm trying to think. Who's still on the team?
A lot.
Just Conforto, DeGrom, Syndergaard, Mats.
Familia.
Cespedes.
Oh, and Cespedes.
Yeah.
But is that it?
I see.
Oh my God!
But that Lugo might also up and not Lugo be. And Gesellman were 2016.
Yeah, but that also. I wonder if that's all that bad. Teams turn over so much nowadays that, like, that might be pretty normal.
Yeah,
but I feel like, I think the reason that there's not as much bitter in the bittersweet with 2015 for me is it never felt like it was supposed to be the Mets year. Like, it just came out of nowhere. It was like they were playing with house money. It was all just free fun. It just felt so like, let's hurry up and have this playoff run before the baseball gods realize that we're playing in their house. Like, it was, just felt very like, I don't know, just so unexpected. Like, unjustified in some ways. It was just like, I'm just gonna appreciate this while it lasts, because this is wild and weird, and that's what's great about it.
Especially after that Padres, oh my God, that nightmare Padres game, and I watched watched that entire game rain delay.
So did I.
And that game just felt like, oh my God, okay, they're not gonna do anything more this season. This is just gonna be okay. They're going to keep losing. This is the start of a horrible part of the season. That game was just a nightmare.
It felt like the knife or the nail in the coffin. Like,
I followed it from a meeting in my office.
I was also at work. I watched it at work.
Up a storm at that umpire, because I was like, why are you calling this right now? Oh my God, why are you saying take a tarp off the field? The rain are showing rain. Oh my God, I was going nuts.
I had such a week that week. I left work early that day because I was going to the U2 concert that night. So I left your work early. So I was at home, watched the end of the game, went to the U2 concert, then I had to off the next day, which was the trade deadline. So, because I'm like, I'll probably be home late. So I took off from work the next day. So then I was just, you know, parked in front of my TV the whole day watching MLB Network. And then 15 minutes before the deadline, it's like, oh my God, Cespedes! And then I was at the Sunday night game that night, because then the Wilmer Flores game was that night. And then I was at the game that Sunday night with Noah Syndergaard. And in my entire life at Citi Field up to that point, I'd never seen Citi Field that loud. And, like, you know, it was nice finally seeing some life in that stadium after it had been dormant for so long.
I think with the Cespedes, so I was also at work during the trading deadlines. It was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon during the week. And I think I have this like distinct memory of when I actually saw it flash across my screen, like on Twitter. I think I stood up so fast that I hit my head on my desk.
Oh, no.
I remember like being like, I stood up because like my desk had like a... like a shelf, like, on top of it, like, above my head, right? So I think I stood up so fast that I, like, clonked my head, and I was like, holy shit!
Well, because the night before, I was, like, coming home from the concert, I was on the train, and I was looking at my phone, I'm, like, looking at all the rumors, and then the rumor at the time was Wheeler for Bruce, and I was like, no!
I was like,
that's gonna help! And I remember just being like fuming on the train going home. First of all, because I was still mad about the game from that they lost to the Padres. And then second, I'm like, what are you doing, Wheeler, for Bruce? Like, this makes no sense.
It's interesting, though. It shows you two things about Sandy Alderson's like frame of mind in that. One is that he really wanted to go for it all that year.
Yeah.
And like, that's why he kept going back to Wheeler, because Wheeler was a non-factor because he was still recovering. So he really was like, really zeroed in, like, this is the year. And he was determined to make a go for it. And that, you know, as much as he, you know, talked to Wheeler and Wheeler said, please don't trade me. And he was like, yeah, I'll try. He also then turned around and like, tried to trade him again.
Yeah.
like 2 days later. And it's just, I mean, this, it's a very, like, once you've read the book, you're like, oh, yeah, that's Sandy, like, thinking outside the block of the box, trying to use a potentially very valuable asset in an unusual way. But then, and also, like, being, like, doing what it takes to do the job in the moment, which was to try to get the Mets to the postseason.
Yep.
But see, also for me, like you were saying, they were kind of playing with house money, and that kind of made it that much better was because it was so unexpected. Like that made it so fun. And it just, you know, it was just like, it was indescribable. But then at the same time, I bought in, I'm like, this is what being a team of destiny is like. So then when they weren't a team of destiny, it was a little crushing. Like, we're never gonna lose. Like, that's it. We're World Series bound. Like, you know, you had to do all the good storylines from the year. You had David Wright coming back. You had them call up Conforto. You had all these, you know, you had the Wilmer Flores. You had Cespedes. It was like, yep, we have too many good vibes. This is it. We're just give us the trophy now. And that's not how it works.
I'm still bitter that it was the Royals in the series and not the Blue Jays, just because
we would have beaten the Blue Jays.
Oh, we would have whipped the Blue Jays' ass.
Not even from a standpoint of beating the Blue Jays, just from a baseball standpoint, the storylines would have been so much fun.
Yeah,
just you had
Dickie.
Oh my God, you had Dickie going up against Syndergaard and Darnot. You had Mats and, oh, shame on me, who was the other Long Island pitcher?
Stroman.
Was Stroman? It was Stroman. You had Mats and Stroman, and wait, there was like another storyline. Oh, the great pitching against the great offense. I mean, Joey Bats.
Yeah, Bautista.
I mean, just, oh my God. I was enjoying the Blue Jays from a baseball standpoint at that point. I just think, aside from it being me just, like, loving, rooting for the Mets, I just would have enjoyed the baseball matchup just enjoying it from, oh my gosh, this is just good baseball, regardless of the teams.
Yeah, the Blue Jays were way more fun. The Royals were just
annoying
and not likable. They were.
No, not likable.
The Royals were headhunting like crazy that year. I was like, ugh!
Yeah.
With Moustakas and no, see, now I'm getting mad.
Yeah, we're going to do walk-off wins. We don't have to be mad.
Okay. Okay, sorry. I didn't mean to like do that little tangent there.
No, you're fine. So yeah, if you haven't read the book, I recommend it. It's really good. Baseball Maverick by Steve Kettman. And if you haven't read it since it came out, then you should probably give it another look in light of the 2015 edition to it. Now we are going to end the show like we always do with walk-off wins, where each of us talks about what is making us happy this week, baseball related or otherwise. Kellyanne Healy, what is your walk-off win?
Okay, so I have been, for the past couple of weeks, dealing with a lot of medical issues. I had the flu. I had a seizure last week. Today was my first day back at work. On my desk at work, my boss left me what's the book? It's by Matthew Silverman. It was a Mets book. I think it's
100 Things to Do.
Yes. To like see or do
year and do before you die or something.
Before you die, like if you're a Mets fan, wait, I'm gonna find the title of this book. 100. Someone else can go while I look this up.
Because I feel like I got that at work too one time.
100 things Mets fans should know and do before they die. That was sitting on my desk this morning at work. And just my wonderful story time families. I am a children's librarian and I do story time. And the kids and the families were just so wonderful and welcoming back. Just the support I received during my recovery was amazing, from my friends, from my family, and especially from Amazing Avenue, especially from, I would like to give a special shout out to, of course, Allison McCaig, and to Brian Salvatore, who sent me this beautiful bouquet of flowers that cheered me up. I like came home from the hospital and there the florist was waiting at my door, and it just made me feel so much better.
Guys, in case you doubt that we love each other in real life, we really do.
We do. Yes.
We're so very happy you're feeling better, too.
Yay.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. That is my walk-off win.
Maggie Wiggin, what is your walk-off win?
So very medical adjacent. This is, I kind of went back and forth on whether this could reasonably be a walk-off win, but I decided that yes, it is. So my son, who's 5, was pretty sick last week. And it's not an unusual type of sickness for a small child, which is like maybe flu or something similar, and with a high fever. And his fever spiked on Thursday, and I called his pediatrician, who had already seen him earlier in the week. And she sort of was like, gently laying the groundwork of like, it's time to take him to the emergency room, which I was not like, I was not really looking forward to it at all, but I did know that our local pediatric ER is supposed to be really good. And that's where the walk-off win part comes, because our local pediatric ER was absolutely amazing. So just for anyone wondering, it's the Morgan Stanley Children's Hospital on 165th Street and Broadway, and their pediatric emergency department. And you usually get to the ER and they're there for hours and hours and hours. We were in and out in under 2 hours. They didn't keep us waiting for more than 10 or 15 minutes at any time. There was a volunteer going around asking what they could bring to make us more comfortable, like some toys, some water. And it was a really like comforting experience when we needed it the most. So just wanted to give a big shout out to Dr. Amato and the whole crew at Morgan Stanley, because you know we needed you and you were there, and that is a wonderful thing. And I do have to make a side note, is that the billionaire name plastered across the Morgan Stanley pediatric ER is Steve Cohen. I also thought that was very interesting. But yeah, so that's my walk-off win. Thank you, Morgan Stanley Children's ER, for taking care of my kiddo, who has made a full recovery. And actually, I mean, they caught his ear infection immediately, and like they gave him a giant dose of antibiotics immediately, and then, you know, prescription for later. So like they really, like, not only did they make us feel good and cared for, is they actually, like, the medical stuff they nailed also. So yeah,
thanks. So excellent. That's so excellent. I'm so happy to hear that, Maggie.
Yeah, that's really good. I mean, when your family member is sick, the last thing you need is any additional stress. So
yeah, for sure.
Linda, what is your walk-off win for this week?
My walk-off win is completely different, but it's the return of real life baseball.
Yay!
Like actual baseball. Like, okay, it's not real baseball. It's kind of still fake baseball, but it's the bat, it's the ball, it's people running around the bases, and you know, it makes me happy. I don't, like I said at the beginning of the show, I'm still very competitive. Like, oh, Matt's gave up a run already. Oh my God, he's in mid-season form. Like, yes, okay. I take it a little too seriously, but I'm just, you know, it's been a strange, long off season, and to actually just, you know, like, this feels normal now. Like, it's this mostly the same game, no matter how many times Rob Manfred wants to change it. And, you know, just, it's kind of like putting on an old, like, comfortable shoe. Like, okay, this is it. We're like, all's right with the world again. Baseball is back on my TV. And, you know, they said it last season, and they like, you could even tell, and they've been talking about it again so far. It's just how much all these dudes like each other and how much fun they're having. Like, today, Jacob DeGrom was, like, talking trash as he was blowing everybody away on the mound. And it was, like, they're good hitters, too. It was, like, Nimmo, Alonso, Cano, and, like, how he told Cespedes the other day. Like, Cespedes is like, take it easy on me. I haven't seen hitting, I haven't seen pitching in 2 years. And he was like, I saw you hit a rocket. I'm not gonna let you do that to me. Like, they're just having fun, and it's baseball, but, like, with no stress, which is also the good kind of baseball right now.
Yeah.
So, and just to see them relaxed and having fun, and, you know, seeing all my boys again that I missed. JD, please get well soon, JD.
Oh, God. If you guys did not hear, I was going to say see the game. It was not broadcast today. I'm sorry. Oh. But if you did not hear, JD jammed his shoulder. He's going to have an MRI tomorrow.
He doesn't think it's concerning. Yeah,
he's like, he said on the, like, the pain scale of, like, 1 to 10, this is, like, a 2 or a 3, he said, so.
Okay. And the other day, he was being interviewed. Andres Jimenez hit a ball, and he goes, oh, well, after he hit it, I'm like, JD, it's me. Like, yeah. That's my goal. So, yeah. It's a walk-off win. It's supposed to be happy, so I'm not going to be upset about JD right now. But, no, because he could be fine. But that's my walk-off win, is that baseball is back on my screen.
Yeah, JD Davis is Linda Sarovich's Patronus.
He is!
And we'll have a broadcast game tomorrow!
Hooray!
Hooray!
So, my walk-off win for this week is, I think I might have made this my walk-off win in the past, but because a lot of my, like, just an outsized number by, like, chance, I guess, an outsized number of my really close friends from college are teachers, and two of them, each, direct their high school plays at their respective schools. So every year I see, like, at least two high school productions of various musicals.
God bless
that's
you.
That's awesome.
Because we always go and support, our friend who's directing the show. So February is usually, like, around the time that they happen. This past weekend, was my friend Kyla, who teaches at Elkton High School in Elkton, Maryland. They did Grease. And so I went with all my friends, and we went and we saw a high school production of Grease, and it was fabulous and at times awkward and at times wonderful, and just like everything you love about like random high school productions of plays just like brings you right back to like your awkward high school days. And like, I wasn't a theater kid in the sense that I like, I didn't do the musicals, but I was like theater kid adjacent in the sense that like I was friends with all the theater kids because I was in choir. So like, it just, it, like these theater kids remind me a lot of me when I was in high school. So, so yeah, it was really fun. So we had a lot of, fun at the show. And then afterwards, we all like went back to the house and hung out, and just had really nice friend time. But part of that was that we got to watch. So there's this new, reality TV show on Disney Plus called Encore. Which is basically a show, a reality show where they find people like 20 years later and have them put on their high school plays again. Like they find, they find like groups of adults who went to high school together and did a high school play together and have them like put the show on again. And they do like a crash, like rehearsal, like just like 5 days of rehearsals, like crash course, and they have them put on the show again. So it just so happened that, and like each episode stands alone, obviously, like as its own thing. So it just so happens that there is an episode where the play is Grease. And so afterwards we like all watched the Disney Plus episode of Grease, which was a high school in Hackensack, New Jersey. So it was, not only was it Grease, it was also extremely New Jersey, which I appreciated. These people were hilarious, and it was people who put on Grease in, oh my god, what year was it? It was like 1990 something. So they're now in their like late 40s, early 50s or something like that. So they got all these people together and like had them re-put on Grease, and it was fabulous and hilarious. It's just like, it's one of those shows that just like kind of like Great British Bake Off or Queer Eye that just like is like really heartwarming and just like really nice. It's like a warm hug to watch it. So yeah, it was really fun getting to watch a high school production of Grease and then a bunch of like middle-aged people putting on a high school production of Grease again. So it was just like a really fun evening. So that's my walk-off win. This weekend I will be seeing a high school production of The Little Mermaid. So
oh, nice. More to come.
So that's my walk-off win for this week. As spring training is unfolding, we will be having coverage of all the spring. We have game threads going up every day for all the spring training games, at least the ones that are broadcast. In the meantime, I need to talk.
Sorry to interrupt. We have them going up for the non-broadcast games, too.
Oh, good. Fabulous. Every day, then. Yay. And I need to talk to Chris about reviving the King of Spring Training contest, which I just remembered is a thing that I need to do. Because that's a thing that I, a feature of the site that I have run in the past that I should start up again. So that'll start up again soon. We've got our game threads. We've got all our news coverage, all of our analysis. We're in the midst of our season preview series. So you'll continue to get those every day for the whole roster. So yeah, go to AmazingAvenue.com, check all of that out. You can follow the site on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Amazing Avenue. You can follow this show on Twitter at A Pod of Their Own. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to Amazing Avenue Audio to get our entire suite of fantastic podcasts. You can follow each of us on Twitter. I am at Petite PhD. Where are you, Linda?
At Linda Servich.
And you, Maggie?
At Maggie162.
Kellyanne, are you have you activated your Twitter, or is your Twitter still dead at this time?
My Twitter is still dead.
Okay.
It's probably going to remain. Oops, sorry. I keep banging into my desk. It is going to remain dead, probably.
Okay. So you can no longer find Kellyanne on Twitter because she's smarter than all of us and has quit the worst app on the internet. But you can find her lopping around in the comments on Amazing Avenue. So see her out there.
Yes, I am. And if you don't know my username is La Roma Bella.
Yeah. Find her on Amazing Avenue. Is the reason that the site has not burned to the ground yet.
So,
but all the people who like have, you know, insulted me over the years, now you know my whole name.
Oh my goodness gracious.
I'm from behind the curtain. So
no, no one come for her or I'ma come for you. So so you can find her in the comments on Amazing Avenue. You can find the rest of us on Amazing Avenue and also on Twitter. You should leave us a review on iTunes once you subscribe. It really helps people find the show. The original intro and outro to this podcast is by Bunga. Let's go Mets, and don't forget, there is no crying in podcasting.